ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिबोधिदां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन ग्रथिदां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायीं अम्ब त्वाम् अनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणीम् यं ब्रह्मा वरुणेन्द्ररुद्रमरुदस्तुन्नन्ति दिव्यैस्तवैः वेदैः साङ्गपदक्रमोपनिषदैः गायन्ति यं सामगाः ध्यानावस्थिततद्गतेन मनसा पश्यन्ति यं योगिनो यस्यान्दं न विदुःसुरासुरगणाः देवाय तस्मै नमः. We are continuing our discussion on the second chapter. Right now, we will deal with the 31st verse of the second chapter. Now, just to give a background, from 11th verse till 30th verse, there are two important topics discussed in this particular chapter. I already mentioned earlier why we begin our discussion with the 11th verse of the second chapter, because that's the beginning of Shankaracharya's commentary. All the verses in the first chapter and in the second chapter up to 10th verse, including 10th verse, give a mythological background, Pauranic background on the story of the Gita found in the Mahabharata. The actual discussion begins with the 11th verse of the second chapter. Now, there are three fundamental topics discussed in the second chapter. First topic is that this body comes and goes. Everything that you find in this world, whatever you recognize, you identify, you come to know of, you objectify, is relative. Now, in the higher transcendental philosophy known as Advaita Vedanta, there's a special principle which may be quite intriguing. One, whatever you see with your eyes is unreal. Whatever you do not see is likely to be real. Now, what does it mean? Unreal doesn't mean absolute unreality. So whatever we recognize, we cognize, using the mind and the five senses of perception, or whatever we connect with the 10 senses, that is five senses of perception and five senses of action and mind, it's called ekadishendriyani. So mind is frequently considered to be a sense of perception in Vedanta, because you don't see anything without the help of the mind. Eyes cannot see things, because you may look at things, but you see things when mind and eyes come together. You may be hearing many voices. I mean, the sound waves may be falling on your ears, but you don't hear. You hear only when the sense of hearing and the sense of mind come together. Like that, the sense of taste, sense of smell, all and sense of touch. So all these five senses of perception need the help of the mind to function, to do their duties and responsibilities. And the senses of action, like feet, hands, etc., cannot function with the help of the mind. So whatever you perceive with your mind, the visual objects, the audio objects, because you perceive them, they can never be absolutely real. Whatever you perceive cannot be absolutely unreal because you perceive them, at least for the time being. but you perceive them differently after some time. So they are not absolutely real, because the absolute reality in Vedanta philosophy means something that remains the same without any change in the past, present and future. And whatever you see, hear, touch and smell and taste won't remain the same for all times. So it is coming and going. So andavanda ime deha nityasyokta sharirinaha. So you found in the earlier verses. The first important lesson in the second chapter is the transitoriness, the transient nature, the changeability of the human body. Symbolically, it implies the changeability, the transience of all empirical phenomenal entities, including the universe, which may be 4.5 billion years old. But before 4.5 billion years, it was different. So this universe also is transient. An insect which lives maybe for a few seconds is also transient. It's a matter of not a difference in kind, but difference in degrees of transience or changeability. That's the first principle. The second important lesson teaching in the second chapter is the unchanging nature of Atman. So the body changes, but the Atman behind the body is not changing. It's eternal. It's everlasting. It never came into existence because there was no time when it did not exist. So it will never cease to exist. So the very word existence itself is not a very accurate word to use in the context of Atman. Now, what is the Atman? The word Atman is a very, very profound word in Vedanta, just like Brahman. The absolute reality, the eternal reality, the eternal subject, that which remains the same without any change, which is immanent in all of us, which is also omnipresent, all-pervading, is also called Brahman as the beginning of the universe, but it's the same. Now, Atma, there is a well-known Sanskrit verse running to four lines in Shankaracharya's commentary. It is yachcha, that it begins like this. Yachcha apnodi yadadatte yachatti visayaniha yachasi santato bhavo tasmat atmedi kathyade. This is the verse. Therefore, it is called Atman. One is apnodi. It means, it is present, simple present means obtaining, reaching, going. So the root is up. So that which is the absolute spiritual goal, attaining, etc., apnodi, that is the highest spiritual goal that should be attained, that should be the goal of all human endeavor. That is Atman. And that which takes everything and receives everything, it adatte adhatu means that which is receiving, taking everything. That is behind the whole function. Atman doesn't drink water when you are thirsty. But without the presence of Atman in your function, in your body, which makes your hands functional, you won't be able to lift a glass of water and drink it. Atman doesn't walk. But when that invisible, immanent, spiritual reality passes out of the human body, the body remains inert. It cannot function. So behind every action, behind every thought, behind everything, there is the Atman. But it itself is not the doer, nor is it the enjoyer of the fruits of actions. And then they say, you know, it eats everything. Atudhadu means eating. What does it mean? It absorbs into it everything. It is all pervading. It is immanent. So it is present in all of us as the immanent indweller. Through immanence, it becomes omnipresent. So omnipresence through immanence. It is present in everything. So it is all pervading. Now, yachasti santato bhavo tasma atmedi uchyate. It is the essence, the reality, the truth, the existence aspect in everything and behind everything. And this Atman, now the people may have some difficulty in understanding this concept of Atman if you try to approach it from either Hindu monotheistic views, Ramanuja, Madhva, Vallabha, Nimbarka, Chaitanya, there are innumerable schools of monotheism in Hinduism, or the Abrahamic religions. If you think, what kind of thing is this Atman? Our God is sitting wonderfully, well sitting in the sky. Vishnu is sitting in the Vishnu's place. Which is very wonderfully well dressed. If you see the Ramayana movies and Mahabharata movies, they all look very wonderfully well dressed and look quite sociable, friendly, compassionate. So these are wonderful ideas about God. But you are talking about this Atman which cannot be seen, which is invisible, which is present in everything, which is all pervading everything. So what kind of God is that God? And what is the use of that kind of a God? This is very, in fact, I was asked this question in a philosophy conference. See, a God whom you cannot see, who is present in everything, all pervading, and who is not involved in any action, and somebody who is not involved in any action, but who is behind every action, you can't expect a lot of good from him. Now, here I will come to this idea. The concept of Atman is the highest concept of the absolute reality whom you call God, the merciful, the compassionate, at different stages of our spiritual life. So when you talk about Advaita, when you talk about the Advaitic concept of Atman as the transcendental, omnipresent, all-pervading, immanent reality, that concept accommodates, it involves, it includes all other conceivable concepts of God. That is why Shankaracharya says, in all non-Advaitic traditions, in all non-dualistic traditions, there is plenty of scope for fighting. My God is the right God. Your God is not so very good. Your book is not so wonderful as my book. But Shankaracharya says, so siddhanta vyavasthasu doitino nischida dhadam parasparam virudhyante taihi ayam na virudhyate. It's a karika from Gaudapada's Mandukya Karika text. It's a commentary in 215 verses on the Mandukya Upanishad. So those who think, or those whose idea, those who stop with monotheism, they're very good people. See, your God may be very compassionate, very kind-hearted, absolutely a good person. But he may be less than compassionate towards others who may worship the same God from a different, slightly different perspective because they are born in another country, another culture, using another language. So they also are worshipping the same God, but they use a different language. A different kind of rituals and liturgy. So there is plenty of scope. So Shankaracharya says, they have differences of opinion among themselves, but Advaita has absolutely no quarrel with anyone because he says Advaita is based on the principle that the same God as the impersonal, transcendental, divine reality is present in everything and everywhere. So with whom will you quarrel? There is no other. So you cannot quarrel with anybody. So this Atman, you talk about Atman, you should remember, it should be understood as the highest evolute, the highest stage in the evolution of the concept of God or the concept of absolute reality. The first great Western Indologist who made this analysis on the basis of his understanding of Rig Veda Samhita was Max Müller himself. He wrote an elaborate introduction where he tried to analyze the evolution of Hindu pantheon on the basis of pantheism, which conceives God as the universe, the world itself, means God and the universe the same. Panentheism, which believes there is a divine reality behind and within every natural phenomenon. And then polytheism, which believes that there is a divine person in the form of some kind of a deity behind every natural phenomenon, which operates, see, behind the clouds, behind the sky, behind the river, behind the water, behind the fire. So Agni is the name of a deity, with fire god. Varuna is a god who supervises all operations of the oceans and things like that. Marut, air. Indra, the lightning. So you find all these ideas in Rig Veda Samhita. So it's a kind of polytheism. And then monotheism implies that there is one supreme god, a presiding deity. There are many Rigvedic mantras which conceives of Indra, Varuna, Agni, etc. as monotheistic godheads, like Vishnu, Shiva, or Jehovah, or God, and so on. Now, and he says, beyond this, there is monism, which doesn't have any conflict with the earlier stages, which accommodates and includes and which absorbs all these earlier stages. See, just like when you get a PhD, you don't study anything that rejects what you studied in the earlier stages of your education. But it includes all that you already studied. So Shankaracharya in Mandukya Upanishad says, suppose you have $1 coin, let us say. There's no coin. The old example is given in Shankaracharya's commentary. And you have a coin with 1/4 of a dollar, half a dollar, and three-fourths of a dollar, and 1 full dollar. Now I'm trying to give a modern version of Shankaracharya's example, which he used in 8th century AD. There was no dollar at that time. What I mean to say, I'm just trying to present in modern context. So he says, $1 coin will accommodate within itself the 1/4 of a dollar coin, or half dollar coin, and 3/7, everything included in $1. Like that, when you reach Advaita, you don't reject anything. You are not in conflict with the early stages of your own spiritual evolution. Rather, you absorb them all into yourself, but you go beyond it. That's why non-dualists have no problem, no quarrel, no conflict with anybody. So Atman should be understood as the highest conceivable idea or concept of the absolute reality, both in spirituality, in theology, and also in philosophy. So that is the that's an approximate understanding of what Atman implies in the context of modern Western monotheistic theological ideas. So second subject is the eternal, immortal, transcendental, immanent, omnipresent nature of Atman. The third subject that is discussed in the second chapter is Swadharma, which is a very, very important subject. in our everyday practical life. So the 31st verse deals with Swadharma. It's a very, very important verse, and this idea is being discussed very elaborately, not only by great philosophers like Shankaracharya or Vivekananda, but even by great thinkers like Gandhi and Mahadev Desai, who wrote on Gandhi, Vinoba Bhave, who was the leader. He was a great Sanskrit scholar and also a great exponent of Ahimsa, non-violence, and distribution of land among the landless people. He was a great leader, a social activist, who led the life of a saint. So, all of them have written elaborately on this particular concept of Swadharma. Now, that's what we are coming to in the 31st verse of the second chapter. Swadharmam apicha aveksya na vikambidum arhasi dharmyathi yuddhat seyo nikshatriyasya na vidyate. This is the verse. Now, I have mentioned earlier that all references to war in Gita should be taken as a metaphor, as a symbol. So that should be understood very clearly. Gita uses the word war, where the war is actually taking place within our own mind, conflicts. So we will have a lot of problems when you talk about, when you think about how we should do certain duties, perform certain responsibilities. It should be done in a certain manner. It should never be done in a certain manner. So, all these ideas are taken into consideration. Now, he says, after discussing the eternal nature of Atman, which is unchanging, which is the same for everyone, which is present in everything, which is one all-pervading reality. He says, now, suppose you ignore all these high-sounding philosophical ideas. Oh, this is enough for me. I'm more of a layman. Arjuna is a soldier, an ordinary person. He was not a great philosopher. Now, suppose you don't worry about these things. Still, from a very, very practical point of view, you cannot escape a duty that has come to you. No, Swadharma is something that comes to you and you do not go after Swadharma. Swadharma comes to you. Certain types of activities that are spontaneous, for example, a student, Swadharma is to study. A teacher to teach. A doctor to treat the patients. Now, one interesting aspect of Swadharma is every ordinary human being will have an inner conviction or understanding of what his or her Swadharma is. That is a psychological principle. There is nobody in the world, even a thief may know, stealing is certainly not the best thing in the world to be done. It may not that he will go for another job, but he knows that certainly there are much slightly better things for earning one's livelihood. So even for people who are used to doing things in the wrong way or doing wrong things, there is always a lingering inner conviction, a voice coming from within, which is not very loud at the beginning, which may be very weak, inaudible voice, is not the right thing to do. Which shows that the idea of Swadharma as a spiritual foundation. And Vedanta tells you that Swadharma is the royal path to liberation or moksha. So, that's why we say, the Swadharma is something that you do not seek. It comes to you. A professor or a doctor, he says, a professional doctor, he doesn't have to think hard to know what his duty is. He doesn't go after that. By virtue of being a doctor, the work of a doctor is swadharma for that person. Now, how do we feel that what we are doing is our swadharma? This is one proof. When we do certain things in a certain manner, we feel a kind of inner contentment. And every ordinary human being who is leading a normal, virtuous life will feel an inner conflict, some kind of a friction within, when he or she does something in a different manner, in an undesirable, inappropriate manner, which shows that you are actually violating a kind of inner rhythm, inner harmony, an inherent harmony of our own nature. That's why swadharma is spontaneous. It is natural. It is the natural pursuit of a natural way of our doing things. Now, the conflict with regard to swadharma is due to one problem. The problem is, first of all, we think that we are this human body. This life or these experiences right in front of me, at present, that's the only thing. There is nothing beyond that, which leads to some kind of ultra pragmatism, utilitarianism, its worst manifestation. I mean, extreme utilitarianism, extreme pragmatism, where you judge everything on the basis of what you get as a result of your actions, which you can enjoy, which you can see for yourself, where the focus is limited to the present, where the mental horizon is very narrow. You don't think of the past, and we don't think of a hypothetical future. We concentrate on the present only, though it becomes a kind of ultra pragmatism. This again is based on the idea that this body is the only thing that we should worry about. So long as we worry only about this body, then we'll worry only about what this body can see and enjoy and experience. So there is nothing which is of any value that goes beyond the physical, beyond the today, beyond the right now. So often the idea right now, today, it is a serious fallacy about it, really speaking. You are actually you're detaching yourself from the past and also from the future and limiting yourself to the present. So let us have a wonderful time right now. We cannot have eternal contentment right now unless we remember the past, and also we need not worry about it, but we should not forget the possibility of a future. So body consciousness, or the idea that this body or the empirical and sensual enjoyments are the only thing that we should worry about, that wrong notion is what actually makes us forget what our swadharma is. The friction is, the conflict is it for me to do this or not? A doctor, a lawyer, or a teacher, a student, or a mechanic really has no need to worry about what his or her job is, or how it should be done and how it should not be done. Then when a conflict arises, it's always due to the basic damage, violence that we do to our own inner system. So long as we continue doing our swadharma, there will be no problem in the world. So in the context of Gita, swadharma, you should remember, see, if you look at the Swadharmam abhicha avekshya. Now, if you look at the whole thing from the standpoint of your own swadharma, then also there is no need for you to worry about the consequences of a righteous war. You should remember Arjuna was a soldier. Let us say he was a guard, an armed guard, standing outside a temple or a church or a school, where his duty is to protect the students in the school or worshippers in the temple or anyone from, protecting them from problems or troublemakers. Suppose that person, well, is it after all necessary for me to do this? Well, even if he tries to escape from his swadharma, swadharma will chase him. The problem is, if you don't do your own swadharma, and if you create a situation where your own swadharma, your own nature to do things chase you, then it will be a very unpleasant experience. That's an important thing. If you don't do swadharma, and if you do the opposite of swadharma is paradharma or, you know, adharma, akarma. There are different words are used. Well, suppose a professor, I'm not interested in teaching. I don't think it's a good job. Students are not so good. So I would rather go and, write some poems. I could do some plumbing work. There's no problem in that. Well, you know, actually, if he is a sincere person, then the lingering feeling of guilt, well, I didn't do my duty to my students who were expecting me in the classroom, that will chase him. And that will create conflicts. Remember, conflicts will come only for people with some principles. And, you know, there is a reason why Lord Krishna chose this man as a disciple. You know, there were five brothers. One is Yudhishthira, Bhima, Arjuna, Nakula and Sahadeva. So Nakula and Sahadeva were too young, comparatively young. Yudhishthira was the senior, the oldest brother. And he was a good man, but sometimes good for nothing in that sense. I mean, actually Yudhishthira knew all the philosophy that Sri Krishna was expounding in Bhagavad Gita. But that knowledge did not have any good effect on him. He was postponing. He was a good man, no doubt. He was a man of principles. But then, sometimes, you know, too much of idealism can be a liability. And that's why he was scolded by his own wife and his own mother. Though he's considered one of the most sattvic type of persons. A lot of good ideas, you know, he was going to heaven. There's a dog that followed him to the last moment before the, you know, not Saint Peter, but maybe Hindu heaven, so to speak, opened the door. He said, "My dog is there behind me. You should give him also an opportunity to enter heaven. Then only I shall come with you," because the dog was following me all the time. And the dog was actually an angel who was incognito, to test this man's integrity. So such a great man he was. He was a great philosopher. So, and not only that, he knew in theory that all that Lord Krishna was going to teach Arjuna. So even if he had told you, "All right, that's fine," he would say, "That's all." But Arjuna was different. Arjuna in a way represents most of the ordinary people living in the world. A lot of good idealism, lot of conflicts, very vigorous, enthusiastic, active, dynamic. And he was ready to do, if he could convince him, this is the right thing to do. He won't hesitate for a moment. He was facing a conflict. If he could teach him properly, "This is the right thing you have to do," he will not waste 1 minute, he will do it. So, and then the third brother, of course, the second brother, Arjuna, there was a Arjuna's elder brother, who was between Arjuna and Yudhishthira, Bhima. He was more of a man of brawn than brain. He was more of a wrestler, a muscular man, a big warrior. So, and you know, he was quite a good man, a man of principles, but perhaps the high philosophy would be too high for him. So Lord Krishna did not choose Yudhishthira as his disciple, because Yudhishthira theoretically knew all that Krishna was teaching Arjuna. Bhima won't understand much of what Krishna was going to teach him. Not that he was dull, but he was more of a man who believed in action at any cost. Arjuna also believed in action, but he also believed in principles. So he wanted to learn those things. Nakula and Sahadeva were too young. So Lord Krishna chose this man, Arjuna, as his disciple. So he says, Dharmyati yuddha chayo nyakshatriyasena vidyade. For a soldier means for a person who has taken to the profession of a soldier for protecting the poor and the weak from evildoers, that job, that profession itself becomes a royal pathway, a door entering to the highest spiritual spiritual realization. He meaning his sorga is mentioned here. Sorga is not the way it's mentioned in the Mimamsaka tradition. Sorga here means higher spiritual evolution. Now, coming to this subject, Lord Krishna doesn't stop there. He says, and he makes another interesting point. And in that comes in the 18th chapter, 60th verse, Lord Krishna says, Subhava jena kaunteya nibaddha svena karmana kartum na ichchasi yen moha karishyasi avashopitate. What it means is, suppose you decide, well, I will not do my duty. This comes in the 60th verse of the 18th chapter. Well, Arjuna was an active person. He was not a saint, please remember. So he talks like a saint in the first chapter. Nakamshe, Vijayam, Krishna, Najarajam, Sukhanija, all you find. Arjuna almost speaks like a Jesus Christ or a Buddha. But he was fully armed to the teeth. If he was a Christ, why should he come to the battlefield armed to the teeth? So there is a hypocrisy. So Lord Krishna says, even if on the impulse of a sudden attraction for a high idealism, you say, well, I will not do my duty. I will not fight. I will go away. Still, he says, if you do not do your duty, if you do not perform your duty and responsibility, as a karma yogi, as an offering to God, as an act of doing good to others, just a doctor doing the job of a doctor, a writer doing the right job of a writer, a mechanic doing the job of a mechanic, like that, if you don't do that, your own inherent nature, your training, which you cannot escape, will force you to do what you are not willing to do joyfully. So even if you try to avoid doing your duty, your responsibility, still there is no way out. Your inherent nature will force you. Avasya means he is a slave in his own hands. He is totally helpless. So that's why we should always try to practice karma yoga. If you do not practice karma yoga, you will be forced to practice karma yoga. See, suppose you do things with great attachment. No, I won't practice karma yoga. I'm doing certain things with a definite purpose, the definite motive. I go for that. Suppose you don't get the expected result, you get the opposite result. You help a person to the best of your abilities, and that person becomes a blackbird, becomes ungrateful, and there is no way for you to respond to that. Then you have to say, all right, this is the nature of the world. Actually, you are practicing karma yoga, but you are forced to take rescue in the idea, this is the nature of the world. Then why don't you understand that at the beginning itself and practice? Do everything. Even if I don't succeed, it doesn't matter. This is karma yoga. I shall do my duty to the best of my ability, even if I do not succeed, or if I succeed only partially, if I don't succeed fully. If this is karma yoga idea, you know, yogastha kura karmani sangam tektva dhananjaya siddha siddhyo samo bhutva samattam yoga uchida. You be established in yoga, not physical yoga, mind you, yoga philosophy is a spiritual philosophy. This philosophy of non-attachment. And so once you get established in this high philosophy of non-attachment and regulate our life accordingly, then there is no scope for any kind of depression or disappointment, even if you do not get the expected result or you get the opposite result. There is no scope for depression. Otherwise, you know what happens? When we do our work with great anxiety, great desire, very great attachment, and we get the opposite result, either we become terribly depressed, disappointed, go for counseling, or we may take refuge, take a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, as Gandhi himself did many times. And well, this is the nature of the world. So you'll be forced, compelled by circumstances to take refuge in the security, the motherly security of Swadharma or Karma Yoga. So better do it voluntarily than doing it compelled by circumstances, forced by circumstances. Because if you do things forced by circumstances, it is very, very unpleasant. It very, 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 very unpleasant experience. To be forced by your own circumstances to take refuge in high philosophy. Of course, it's better than never turning to high philosophy. Even by compulsion, if you turn to high philosophy, is better than never turning to high philosophy. So that's why Lord Krishna says, even if you do not practice your Swadharma, your inherent nature will chase you, will prick your conscience, and you will not be able to sleep, have good sleep. Therefore, there is no escape. So actually, Lord Krishna is putting before us a very interesting high philosophy. Shankaracharya has got a very wonderful, you know, not Shankaracharya, Neelakanda. Shankaracharya says, Prithvi jayadvarena dharmartham prajarakshanartham cha idi dharmat anapetamam. And this means, Arjunasya anatmani dehi atmadhi atmani anatmadhi rupaha moha nivaritaha idanim sudharme yuddhe atharma Atharmadhiruva moham nivarayati. Neelakanda is another Tikakara. You know, commentary. Tika means short notes on a commentary, explaining some of the obscure points of a Greek commentary. So Shankaracharya says, Prithvi jayadvarena dharmartham prajarakshanartham. If a soldier does his duty, prajarakshanartham means for the protection, for the security, for the safety of those who are in need of security and safety, that itself becomes a Swadharma for him. Just as a doctor's Swadharma is to treat the patient, so also soldier's Swadharma is to do his duty, his use his skills and professional status to do something which is expected to do. Now the point is, if a person doesn't do that, there are two problems. Circumstances will physically force him to do that, or his own mind will become a tormentor, torture him, if he's a man of principles. If he's not a man of principle, then circumstances will force him to do that, and that's a very, very unpleasant experience. That's why Shankaracharya says, you know, Prithvi jayadvarena dharmartham prajarakshanartham cha idi dharmat anabetam. And then also the commentator, Tikagara, the super commentator says, Arjunasya anatmani dehi. Arjuna thought, well, this body is atman, nothing more. So, for so long as we consider this body as the only thing, as the only our identity of ours, then we will think whatever this body comes in contact with, that's the only thing that is existing. As I mentioned earlier, you know, the body should not be neglected. Body and all the sense objects also should be given their proper place, proper status. Vedanta is not a life-negating, world-negating philosophy of over asceticism. Vedanta is actually it's a way of facing the realities of life in this world in a very intelligent manner. What Sri Ramakrishna is saying, living in the world without being part of it, without being worldly minded, we can live in the world. So, the body as a place, I mentioned this earlier, you know, the Kumara Sambhava, there is, you know, apikriyartham sulabham samit kusam jalani visnana vidhikshamaniti apiswashaktya tavasi pravartase sariramadhyam khaludharma sadham. Is one of Kalidasa's kavyas you find. So Shiva, taking the form of a brahmachari, comes and tests the devotion of mother, and then you know, he gives a twist to the philosophy. You know, first of all he asks after the welfare, then he says sariramadhyam khaludharma sadhanam. So the meaning is, this body is dharma sadhanam. It is an instrument for doing swadharma, our duty to ourselves and to the rest of the world, to our family, to the country, and also to the very concept of human civilization. So adhyam, the traditional commentary, the most important commentary on Kalidasa's Mahakavyas is Mallinatha Sanjeevani. He says, adhyam means mukhyam dharma sadhanam. The most important, the most significant instrument in our hands, which we don't have to buy from the markets, is in our own hands, is the human body, which is a noble instrument with which we can study great things, we can do great things, we can achieve great things, but only when you look upon this body as an instrument, as a means, not as a goal. The moment you think of this body as a goal, then all these problems will begin. After all, I mentioned earlier, you know, as a means, it is wonderful. All these great sages, philosophers, saints and scientists, they worked with their body. Without the human body, no one can work. One of our great swamis in India used to say, dharma doesn't have hand and feet. So dharma needs 2 feet to stand and 2 hands to work with. So dharma needs an instrument. But if you look upon the body not as an instrument, but as a supreme goal, the only thing existing, then remember, the body, there is nothing inside this skin bag which is very remarkable, which you can be very proud of, which you can write home about. It is something. If you have to use sanitizer or soap, if you touch with your hand, anything that comes out of the skin bag. So that means, apparently it may look wonderful, but inside there is nothing so spectacular, so very wonderful about it. But the same body was used by Shankaracharya, by Jesus Christ, by Buddha, by Einstein, scientists, thinkers, philosophers, Aristotle, Vivekananda. All of them use the same kind of physical body, and they did great things, they achieved great things, they accomplished great things, and as times go on, the stature grows higher and higher long after their body has vanished from this earth. So that's why, you know, swadharma vicha aveksha navikampidu karma dharmya yuddha chayo nikshatriyasya. So we'll continue the discussion in the next session. Now we can have interaction maybe around 10 minutes.
Swamiji, the Atman cannot be seen. Yeah. But what about the Jiva Atman? What is the relationship of the Jiva Atman to the Atman?
Yeah, Jiva Atman is the reflection of this this Paramatman in our buddhi or mind. I shall try to explain this. When a person dies, his physical body comes to an end, his physical senses also come to an end, his physical mind may come to an end, but he'll be born with an inheritance. his accumulated karmas, vasanas, vritti, samskaras will accompany him when he is born again. These samskaras will be accumulated in the mind or buddhi. Both are used as a synonym in this context. So, Atman reflects on a mind or buddhi. Depending upon the samskaras, which color, which influence the mind, our behavior, our life, everything will happen. So, it is nothing but a reflection. You know, suppose there are 10,000 pots with water, filled with water, and one sun above. Like that, we have 8 billion, if you believe the total human population is 8 billion. 8 billion mirrors on which the same Atman is reflected. The reflected reflection is called Jivatma. It is not different from Paramatman, because whatever is reflected on the mirror is a semblance of Paramatman, but it is different. It is not different, but it is different. Because you look at the mirror. Without you, there will be no face visible on the mirror. But the reflection on the mirror is not you, obviously. But it is certainly not entirely different from you. There is a resemblance, there is a similarity, but it's not the same. So, just as your face will be reflected in the mirror, so also Paramatman is reflected on the mirror of our own, the antakarana or mind or buddhi. So long as this is colored and influenced by samskaras, accumulated vrittis, vasanas and samskaras, the reflection may not be very pure. The moment our mind becomes pure, the reflection becomes more and more accurate. And when the reflecting medium goes away, then the reflection merges with what is reflected. Now, what is the meaning of the reflecting medium, the mirror going away here? It means that through spiritual practices, sadhana chatushtaya, sravana marana nididhyasana, what we call through contemplation, when we realize that we are actually that Atman, not this physical body or mind, at that time, you dissociate yourself from this body-mind complex, then the reflecting medium is gone. What is reflected merges with the real thing, prototype. There are three different schools in Vedanta. We explain this. It is later I will describe. One is Bimba Pratibimbavada, which I explained just now, you know, reflection, you know, Bimba Pratibimbavada, Avachedavada, and Abhasavada. Three philosophical schools in Vedanta, which emerged during the post-Shankarite time, based on Shankara's bhashyas, which explain this. So we'll come to that later.
I have a question on Swadharma.
Yeah.
You know, when we talk about the many examples like that, he had one example was to free the media people. And Jesus had one purpose in mind, to save mankind from ignorance, etc. But the normal people like myself, we have different things. Our mind is kind of spread out in various ways.
Yeah.
We have to, like right now, I'm trying to learn.
Yeah.
I believe that's my dharma.
Yeah.
But in the morning, I was working in the office and doing something else. And in the middle, I was doing things for the family. Yeah. So how does this work? If your dharma is so spread out in various activities,
Gandhi's work was more spread than any of us. He was a lawyer and he was organizing these mass agitations. He was writing books. And I think, you know, even his participation in India's freedom struggle, so far as he was concerned, was, for so far as she was concerned, was a karma yoga swadharma. You know why this becomes clear? He never expressed any kind of dejection or depression or total disappointment. There were many, many occasions when his own followers rejected some of his proposals. But this man never really, he was never worried. So you find, we can say Gandhi, Christ also, you know, Christ's life also full of struggles, being tempted by the Satan. Of course, believe in all the stories you find. And he was himself betrayed by St. Thomas. And he himself, you know, went to the temple and how he dealt with the traders, and Jewish money lenders and so on. One thing we can say, they were more advanced, much more advanced than any of us in the practice of karma yoga, let us say. But still, overall, if you can keep an ideal of non-attachment, that will help us to from worrying too much about a problem when it occurs. So, and at the root of karma yoga, there is another important ideal which I didn't get time to explain. That is, certain fundamental things we consider as top priority. And other things which is not insignificant but subservient to that. So many of these great karma yogis have some higher ideals. Apart from the work they were doing, some higher ideals which they held fast to. You find that in the lives of great karma yogis. They were doing work with great dedication, with great application, great sense of, great enthusiasm, like Gandhi working for India's independence and so on. But still, even in the midst of that, his mind was always full of some high idealism that went beyond the work of fighting for the country's freedom or the possible results or consequences. He was not so much obsessed with those things. So very often in the midst of being immersed in all these activities, they were able to keep themselves away from it. And that keeping away from them mentally, which kind of non-attachment, is possible when you link yourself to some higher ideal. So when you link yourself to a higher ideal, then you can immerse in all your daily duties and responsibilities with great enthusiasm. But if there's a problem, it won't have a devastating impact on you. It may be a problem, you may be worried about it, but it won't shock you the way it can shock an ordinary person who has no ideal at all. So, on the one hand, we are doing all our different kinds of duties and responsibilities, engaged in different activities. On the other hand, internally, at the back of our mind, we feel we are linked to some higher ideal. So this higher ideal enables you to remain somewhat detached or use this art of detachment when there's a problem. If we are not able to do that, the problem becomes a very big problem. When we are able to practice this detachment or non-attachment, problem is there. Well, all right, it comes and goes, part of the world. You can see that. Frequently we do that in our daily life. When many of you who are coming to Vedanta Society, I know many of who do that. Their mental health is much better. They do have some difficulties and problems, professional things, all that. But somehow they're able to, it's there, but it is not the only thing, there is something higher. That's why people drive all the way in difficult weather to come all the way from distant places. They're trying to link themselves to something higher and transcendental. That helps us to deal with these problems in a more intelligent manner. That's it. Action and contemplation going together. Yeah. Contemplation doesn't mean running away from action, but it helps you to look at the problem of action, field of action, from a higher perspective. It doesn't make you indifferent to the challenges, but it conserves energy and enables you to look at these challenges from a higher perspective. That's the idea behind. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.